You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Why don't we go ahead and get started? I'm Richard Bush, the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this program on international organizations in Taiwan. Thank you all for coming. We have four really good panelists. Jacques Delisle came all the way from Philadelphia, and President Professor Li Wei-jin came from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I'm not sure who gets the prize for coming the furthest. Sandy Ye, to my left, came all the way from Taiwan, but she's a visiting fellow here at Brookings, so she didn't come just for this, and she's been here a couple of weeks, and my good friend Bonnie Glazer as well. Before we turn to the panelists, I'd like to make a couple of comments on why I think this topic is important. First of all, there's a very practical reason, and that is Taiwan can contribute to the solution of regional and global problems. It's exposed to transnational crime and harbors criminals from other places. It has weather. It produces greenhouse gases. It suffers from transnational epidemics. And it has two very good air carriers. And there are international organizations to address all the issues in these various spheres and others. But Taiwan is excluded from the work of many of them, and that constrains the efforts and the fact that Taiwan is constrained from participating in these organizations diminishes any effort to address them well. That's partly because Taiwan does have an impact in these areas. It's also because Taiwan has some really outstanding officials who have expertise on these areas. Second, there's a political reason, and that is that for two decades, the Taiwan public has been increasingly unhappy at being excluded from international society. I remember probably 20 years ago, Annette Liu, who went on to be vice president of Taiwan, came to me on Capitol Hill and talked about her desire to advocate that Taiwan should return to the United Nations or become a member of the United Nations. Taiwan people feel that they have a contribution to make, and they want a little dignity. Now, we all understand why Taiwan doesn't participate in the work of international organizations, and it's China. This issue of Taiwan's role in international organizations is part of a continuing struggle over which government, the PRC or the ROC, will represent the state called China in the international system. Also, in more recent years, China has worried that Taiwan's desire for international participation is part of a plot to create a Taiwan state, totally separate from China. The Ma administration, at least, has sought to reassure Beijing about any separatist intentions. That is, it doesn't have them. And Taiwan is not seeking membership. It knows that's a bridge too far. What it seeks is meaningful participation. So it raises the question of whether the cost to international society of excluding Taiwan and the cost of denying Taiwan a little dignity is an acceptable price to pay for allowing Beijing to preserve its dignity and its diplomatic equities as Beijing defines them. Finally, there's the question of cross-strait relations and the effort to stabilize cross-strait relations and maybe at some point resolve the fundamental dispute between them. There does Beijing's effort to constrain Taiwan in the international system. Is that really the right way to win the hearts and minds of the Taiwan people, which they say is their goal? There's a bigger issue. How does the Taiwan's desire for a role in the international system does have a bearing on whether it can be seen as a sovereign entity for purposes of cross-strait relations. And finally, I personally think that the big question of our time is, what kind of great power is China going to be? I think that how China addresses the Taiwan Strait issue is a good litmus test of that. And within that subject, how it addresses Taiwan's international space is also an important question. So let's start our program so that you can hear from our distinguished experts. First is Professor Li Weijin. He's a professor of political science at Wake Forest University, and he's going to talk about the status of Taiwan's participation in international organizations.
Thank you. Let me bring out the PowerPoint. It doesn't come out. Oh, but then the screen. Okay. Sorry. Because there are some figures, so I thought it would be probably much helpful to have the PowerPoint. But first of all, I would like to thank the institution and the chair for the invitations. And since I have only about 10 to 12 minutes, since the time change, daytime changes, so I'm going to sprint forward very quickly. It's our allocation of time, roughly 10 or 12 minutes or so. First of all, once you see the... It will be here.
Okay. Is that it?
No, that's not mine. Okay. It will be from this cabinet. First of all, I want to mention that the figure you're going to see that's basically coming from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Taiwan. So the definition of international organization, again, it's very broad. And so you're going to see the total numbers of figures probably more than what we usually have seen. So the total right now, 51 IGOs are... The reason I say it's a definition very broad, since I'm the person also teaching international organization, we always got the debate. When we teach an international organization, it's supposed to be international organization or international organizations. It's a plural form or singular form. If you teach a singular form, sometimes you talk more on the theoretical part of it. But then still, sometimes they're more interested in the concrete stuff. And so sometimes we probably pick up the particular United Nations. We talk about the United Nations. We talk about some of the major international organizations. So here, the definition of international organization, IGO sector, is very broad. So the total number right now, according to the data, will be 51. And the full member status will be 32. And observer status, 15. And associate members, only 2. And there's some interesting member status, corresponding members. And there's one. And actually, that's a cooperating, the final one cooperating non-members, that's actually one. This is a different from my, sorry. Doesn't function anymore. Sorry. It freeze. Keep on going. Projector slide you're going to see is that basically divided from the time periods. So prior to 2000, you'll be able to see the full membership, 21, and observer status, that would be 7. And then the corresponding will be 1, and cooperating non-members will be another 1. 2000 to 2008, full membership will be 8, observer status will be 7, and associate member will be 2. After 2008, they acquire 3 full membership and 1 observer status in organizations. The next slide you're going to see, that will be a breakdown in terms of categorizations, in terms of the functional areas. So 24, that would be for economic trade and finance and anti-money, for example, laundering, that area. So 24 pretty much get into the economic side, trade, finance, that side. 8 will be agricultural related, and 7 will be fishing related, and 5 will be in the general areas, and 4 will be in the science and biology status. Okay. Does it work? Okay. Great. So that's pretty much the data I want to show to you. And so you can see that the distribution in terms of the time period. And the next one, that would be in terms of the categorization, 24 in economic. The point I want to draw your attention would be, yes, Taiwan probably concentrated a lot in the economic trade, finance, that areas. But in terms of the new transnational areas or transnational issues, Taiwan probably still need to push a little bit more. Particularly, we realize that Japan's recent earthquakes and tsunami, all those areas pretty much require transnational or transgovernmental cooperation of it. And then in terms of full participation, again, in terms of full membership, that's the tricky part really comes in. Sometimes Taiwan is classified as a customs territories or the regional entity or economic entity or the state, but most likely it will be in the economic entity in a sense, or maybe in terms of, for example, a World Trade Organization, that would be custom, special custom territory, those areas. So it's getting to the muddy waters whether Taiwan's sovereign statehood is really brought out through the participation of international organizations. They also have associate members, and associate members, again, it varies in different kind of entity. So they take part in policy deliberations with similar rights of the regular members, but they don't have a voting right. Okay. And the typical example, that would be the General Conference on Weights and the Majors, and it's from 2002, that's Chinese Taipei. And then the observer status, again, granted to non-members states or to member states, which really want to join, but then unfortunately there are some kind of political barriers over there. Okay. And then the observers sometimes, for example, granted to the National Liberation Organization, for example, in the UN, we're all quite familiar with it, the Palestinian Liberation Organizations or some of the international organizations within the international organization, they're affiliated with the international, other international organizations or observers. And then again, they don't pay contribution sometimes, and sometimes they don't even vote. They cannot circulate the official document, because again, it depends on different organizations' requirement. The only thing is probably very beneficial, that would be they have access to the informal decision-making process. In other words, in the cocktail parties or maybe in some kind of conference meeting, they are able to attend and then contribute some opinions for it. But that really, again, varies, depends on the cases. And then corresponding members, pretty much Taiwan has only 1, and then they don't have a voting right, like the observers, but then, again, they sort of indicate they are willing to participate, they want to receive the information, they want to be on the listserv to some extent. That's Chinese Taipei, there's only 1, and then that one is the International Organization of Legal Metrology, corresponding members, they also got 54 states and economies. And then the final one is cooperating, corresponding non-members. Okay, there's another one. So you can see all the examples. I'm going to run through very quickly. For example, ADBs, Taipei Common China. And so continue going on for the APEC, that would be Chinese Taipei, and the Asian Productivity Organization, even though the name is Republic of China, but actually the representative of participating in the organization, that would be China Productivity Centers. In other words, that's really put into different categories of the international organizations. But then for Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they put it together. You also have the International Satellite System for Research, for Search and the Rescues. That's basically Zhonghua Denxin. Zhonghua Telecoms decided to put into that particular organizations or the companies to be the representative. And then the final one I want to mention, the Egmont Group. For most of the Taiwanese, we're quite familiar with this one because they track all the financial data, transactions, money laundering information. And then so when former Chen Shui-bian, president of Taiwan, got all kinds of problems, and a lot of information actually coming from these particular organizations. Okay, and also the World Customs Organization. I just tried to bring out some of the examples in terms of the Taiwan's participation in different names. If you look at all these examples, and then you're going to see that the name really varies. What's in the name? Now, sometimes it's an interesting question. If you get into the linguistic studies, you got the Republic of China, you got Taiwan, you got Taipei, common China, you got Chinese Taipei, you got customs territories. You know, you also mentioned about economic entity and then, and again, fishing entities, health entities, and then you have the, even using the participating organizations and to indicate that, well, that's really representing, Taiwan. Okay. And then all of this is certainly go back to, one particular example, that would be International Olympic, committees. This one, certainly we can argue that that's not the IGO. It's not even listed on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs websites because that's really a non-governmental organization, strictly speaking, legally speaking. Okay. And so you got the Chinese Taipei Olympic Committees, and then translated into Chinese, it becomes Zhonghua Taipei. It's not Zhongguo Taipei. Zhonghua sort of indicating in the cultural sense that it's Chinese, but then actually politically speaking, that's different. Okay. And then also in terms of opening ceremony, if you watch all those hooplas of the opening ceremony, you're going to see that Chinese Taipei actually classified going along with the T group instead of a C group. Again, there is a political understanding as well as the consensual memorandum of understandings putting this one. Okay. But at least the success of this particular negotiation really bring out Taiwan's willingness in terms of flexibilities, in terms of calling names to some extent. My final point is really Taiwan tried to get into the international communities. It's the same rights and duty, but who cares about name to some extent? As long as the name does not cause the domestic problems as well as the international confusions to some extent. So, at the same time, for the international organization, they're also willing to accommodate to both. Accommodate both. Both meaning that you got China on one side, Taiwan on the other side, and at the same time they try to maneuvers between all those competing interests. This one I bring up because this one has been the model for a lot of NGOs as well as some of the IGOs. And the Asian Development Banks, Taiwan was the original members, and so it was called the Republic of China until 1985. Then it started from 1986. So negotiations, it changed to Taipei Common China. And then, again, that's a negotiation process. China, under Deng Xiaoping's leadership, Deng at that time said, well, you cannot allow them to have the Republic of China if you want me to join in. And so he proposed a Taiwan Common China, and certainly Taiwan cannot accept it. And so U.S. proposal, counter-proposal, and at the same time with the congressional pressures, also decided to propose a Taipei Common China. And Taiwan certainly for 2 years decided not to participate it, but then they don't decide to participate. But every time Taiwan participates, suddenly put a sign over there under protest, because they don't like this kind of name. But then I still want to participate. Okay. That's the resilience of the Taiwanese delegate. So they have same kind of rights, actually, everything in terms of ADBs. And if you go to the ADB's websites, they talk about member countries, but then they really put a quotation over there. When they talk about countries, they indicate that there's no reference in terms of sovereign independent status. So in other words, for the ADB, they say, well, it's the economic functions, activities, economic entities. Okay. And then again, another accommodation will be they don't, in the headquarters, they only fly the ADB flag, no national flags of the members in the headquarters, unless there's a session in member states, and then the member states, certainly they can fly their national flag. So this, again, this is another breakthrough to some extent, and then the name change, Taiwan certainly very reluctant, but Taipei, without common this time, Taipei, China, also, if you check on the EBRD, European banks on reconstruction and development, and again, they put the Taipei, China, and actually they got the Taiwan's flag over there on the website. And, so that's sort of becoming a model. Again, ADB, they also got institutional, accommodations, and China at this moment, at this particular time, again, political contextual environment becomes very important, timing. China at that time, they are willing to accept this name is because China really are looking for a lot of aid or loans from the ADBs. So they are willing to accommodate. APEC is another one. The economic entities and Chinese Taipei, again, through the understandings, memorandum of understandings in 1991, they changed name Chinese, they decided to have this name Chinese Taipei, but then they also indicated that Minister of Foreign Affairs or the, Taiwan's political leaders cannot attend any kind of meetings except the Minister of Economic Affairs can attend the meetings. China emphasized very much on one China principles. Okay. And but because the APEC membership also lead to three other organizations and Chinese Taipei as an economic entity, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong also joined the APEC simultaneously. WTO is another issue. This one, everyone quite familiar, joined the WTO as a special customs territories. But again, in a brief reference, they refer to the Chinese Taipei. Okay. And the WTO membership also bring out additional membership in those WTO-affiliated organizations. And that's the reason at the beginning of the slide I show you 51, but sometimes you can say, well, 40-some, because Taiwan counted those affiliate organizations also as an individual one. But that doesn't necessarily mean that in the process everything is very smooth, and you can see that, for example, just read the website or news reports or all kinds of paper discussion, how are we going to change, translate the name? Chinese Taipei, it becomes 中国 Taipei or 中华 Taipei. And again, everything got a different connotation, hidden agenda behind it. And they also changed the permanent missions to Economic Trade Office to some extent. And if there is a trade dispute, WTO does have the dispute settlement mechanism or dispute settlement bodies. And they have different kind of procedures. When they are in the negotiation, China in one particular case decided to send a document in Chinese only. It's supposed to be a different language. In Chinese only, send it to Taiwan and address to Taiwan. It's simply just 中国 Taipei. And certainly China, Taiwan was not very happy about it, protested, all talking about Taiwan's mission in WTO. It basically called the Economic Trade Office, pretty much like Hong Kong's office or Macau's office. Okay. And then final one I want to mention, Inter-American's Tropical Tuna Commission. Since I love sushi, I cannot escape this one. Taiwan actually is a very substantial player in terms of fishing activities. So all of this is eventually IATTC decided to invite Taiwan to join. And then previously, they just called Taiwan. Then later on, when they decided to join, because China also wanted to join, they decided to set up organizations, a format. So they asked Taiwan to join in 2009, and the name will become Chinese Taipei. It actually, the first session was not very pleasant according to one scholar's participation. China demanded that, well, Taiwan's flag, Taiwan's name, Taiwan, everything, anything touch upon Taiwan, supposed to be excluded from the documentation process, and they eventually couldn't get whatever China wished. They simply just veto it because the decision-making procedure is supposed to be based on the unanimous decision. So one vote, veto everything. So it's really a difficult situation, but at least maybe hopefully in the future that will be much better. Here I want to show you that in the recent articles I published with my co-authors, T.Y. Wong as well, Yu Xinzi, and then we got some data in 2008. If you give Taiwanese voters some of the choice and you ask them and say, well, what kind of name do you want? And then they will say, well, Republic of China, Taiwan, and the Chinese Taipei, and you can see that Chinese Taipei only 7.4%. And the survey actually done by Zhengzhi University's election centers, they're quite reputable and reliable. And so you can see that in 2008, the data will be showing that, well, Republic of China and Taiwan actually they are preferred to some extent, Chinese Taipei. Well, they are not preferred. And certainly, again, you need to go back to identity politics in Taiwan. If you take out the ROC and Taiwan, okay, Taiwan, common China, and Chinese Taipei becomes a preferred one. So it's an interesting part. If pragmatic attitudes towards Taiwan's participation in international society. But keep this one in mind. Okay, what are the benefits to Taiwan? We all remember the Robert Putnam's bowling alone, you know, quite long sums. You go to bowlings by yourself, no competition, no networking, no that kind of community sense. Okay, and Taiwan's situation pretty much indicated into that kind of phenomenon. You say, well, I want to participate, but then I try to do everything, but then no one cares. And that's really, if you generate it into a domestic politics, it's a sense of a loss, a sense of a sadness. You cannot deny Taiwan's economy is good, in relative comparison, of course. And then in terms of all other issues, and Taiwan deserves to be part of the international community, but you want to contribute, you want to participate, you want the voice, but then, well, they don't want you. And then that sense of frustration really very high. But at the same time, if you look at it, if Taiwan can participate, you can reduce the transaction costs internally, okay, internal politicking process, Taiwan, China, Taiwan world, and you can really reduce the transaction cost. Peace promotion, because, for example, WTO, you do have a dispute settlement procedures, or in any different kind of international organization, at least to provide a forum for discussion. Economic benefits, consultation, for example, Taiwan joined all kinds of development bank, goes through the long aid process, sometimes they can get some of the economic benefits of it. Democratic aspirations, okay, interest articulation, interest representation for 23 million peoples. Okay, prevent political spoilers in domestic politics from using the international frustration as some kind of a political gain in electoral process, causing all kinds of problems. Confirmation of a 1992 consensus. Actually, it's a win-win game. If you want to win the hearts and minds, well, where are you going to go? You know, very simple things. Allow them to participate. And on the counterpart, that means Taiwan, actually, they're quite pragmatic, particularly under the current administrations. Okay. And then a whole in the global commons, we are familiar with the tragedy of the commons, okay, free rider problems, and all these kind of issues. So if Taiwan over there forgotten to some extent, you got not necessarily like a green gas and that kind of hole over there is in Arctic, you know, that regions, but in Arctic regions, but then, you know, at the same time, global commons actually you want to have more participation. The final one is a diplomatic link. Go through the international organization. Actually, you can talk to those countries which you don't have diplomatic ties. That really a beneficial one. What are the benefits to the global communities? Process legitimacies for the output legitimacy for the creation of international norm. Actually, we are talking about the standardization of international communities. We're talking about the creation of international norms. The more participation actually strengthens the efficiency and the effectiveness of the international community or governance. Or you can avoid the jurisdictional gap, the operational gap, or incentive gap for particular transgovernmental issues. Free rider problem is always there. Taiwan doesn't want to be a free rider, but then, if that's the case, take them in, and then you solve partial, not completely partial, free rider problems. And the final one is the connection between the people, IGOs, for the fairness of the global governance. And that's pretty much that's the argument I want to present it, saying that, well, Taiwan really deserves it, and particularly on the counterpart, Taiwan doesn't mind too much about the official name really sticking to it, and there is some kind of solution, there is some kind of compromise. That's the end of it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Lee did mention he has a... Sorry. Dr. Lee has an article in the current Journal of Contemporary China, if you want to know more. Now, Sandy Ye will talk about the international dimensions of law enforcement and fighting trafficking of women. Sandy?
Thank you, Richard. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to be here to share with you some of my observation on Taiwan's participation in international organization with the focus on law enforcement and women. 2 months ago, I was attracted by an obituary of the father of a Hong Kong movie star. Normally, I was not a big fan of entertainment news, but this deceased, Mr. Zhang Kaiyun, happened to be a police officer, a very famous police officer in Hong Kong. And actually, a movie was made even, you know, based on his story. And he was wanted by Hong Kong's ICAC, Independent Commission Against Corruption, since 1977. His boss and his good buddy, Lee Rock, was even more famous. He had a nickname. We called it a detective with $500 million. That's how rich he was. And they were both indicted and wanted by ICAC. But see what happened. Even after 14 years of his being wanted by ICAC, there was a movie made under his name, and even call him a legion of Hong Kong. How ironically. As a matter of fact, both Lee Rock and Major Dan, they fled to Taiwan after they were wanted by ICAC and lived there ever since until they were both summoned by God. Lee Rock passed away last year at the age of 90. And Mr. Zhang, as I mentioned earlier, died recently at the age of 94. They both led a pretty good life. And people may wonder why Taiwan would be a safe haven for foreign outlaws. The fact is, actually, there's no bilateral or multilateral agreements between Taiwan police and Hong Kong or even the neighbor countries. And there's no extradition agreement signed either. This problem may occur to almost every country, not only in Taiwan or Hong Kong. So that's why we need an international police organization. The Interpol is the world's largest. We name it the largest international police organization because it has the 188 member states. By this greater membership, it can cover almost the entire world. And it was established at the cross-border police corporations. They try to prevent or combat international crimes. And even they have a structure, you know, by their constitution, every country has a national central bureaus. Each member state has a national central bureau. And it's typically, it's a division under the national police force. And the Interpol will interact with the their member state by providing capacity building or police training and a very efficient I-24/7 secure communication system. This I-24/7 communication system stands for information 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And it's designed to enable all the police in the world to exchange information securely and rapidly. They even provide database sharing information. For example, once country has known criminals, then we can look up into all the fingerprint database or DNA database or stolen cars, stolen passports, so on and so forth. And the Interpol even issues different types of international notice. There are six different colors, ranging from, for example, the yellow notice means the missing person, and the most serious one will cause the serious tension of every country is a red notice, the most wanted fugitive. And at the age of, you know, terrorism, they even, you know, cooperated with the UN to issue Interpol UN special notice against terrorists, Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Taiwan, just as mentioned by, you know, Dr. Lee's presentation, actually we joined the Interpol at pretty early time. We applied to be a member in 1961, and we had a national central bureau NCB stationed in inside a criminal investigation bureau of National Police Administration. But in 1984, when China applied for the membership, and with a request that Taiwan should be downgraded to be a sub bureau of China, this become a big no for Taiwan government at that point of time. So Taiwan was forced out Interpol. But we still remain the NCB's units inside the Criminal Investigation Bureau. We claim that we exchange information and intelligence with other countries by that's by telegram and fax, not the I-24-7, because we don't have any authorization code anymore. And we still acknowledge the international notice. Instead, Taiwan still try to be internationally active by attending as many conferences or associations, as many as possible. But we can see all the conferences or the associations, they are more like a social network or clubs. We try to be heard by international law enforcement community. But what else we can do? So we started to send out police attachés to now. There are eight countries we have police attachés. We also work with foreign law enforcement agencies through their representatives or attachés in Taiwan or even in Hong Kong, in anywhere. We have several, you know, success stories. For example, 2 years ago, when FBI notified Taiwan, there was a child molester in Taipei. And we recognized the notification and we found this guy and arrested in like 5 days and sent it back to the United States. And he now, I think this trial is still going on in California. And 2008, we helped the U.S. Secret Service to solve a super note case, a counterfeit American bills case. The face value is like $400,000 U.S. dollar. But worth mentioning here is that this kind of, you know, cooperation, I would say it's just like a one way. Whenever we receive a notice from our counterparts in U.S., in Australia, in U.K., or in Hong Kong, we will try our best to help our friends to apprehend, to arrest these criminals, try our best. But how about the Taiwanese criminal escape to other country? Then there will be no extradition agreement or no so-called treaty, bilateral agreement signed up. And now let's go back to, globalized crime. This is my the subject of my research here in Brookings, human trafficking. As President Obama mentioned, everybody can be victims of human trafficking. This is a crime beyond border. And Secretary Clinton mentioned that we need partnership, not domestically, but also internationally, to combat this crime. And the United Nations, UNODC, Office of Drug and Crime, they claim that 80% of the detected victim of human trafficking are women and girls. But under the influence of UN's One China policy, there's no way for Taiwan to be part of it, to be part of the global partnership. I was a leader of a women NGO back in Taiwan. And in early years, like early 2004 or 5, I was able to participate in some UN's conference or activities as an individual expert. But in the past few years, like last year, I went to New York City trying to provide my professionalism or my experience at UNCSW, Commission of Status of Women. I was rejected because I am a Taiwanese passport holder. If I, present my expired driver's license, Illinois driver's license, I can be admitted. But that's so ridiculous, even they know who I was, and I was just, participated as a member of INGO, but still I was denied. So if Taiwan, as long as Taiwan remains excluded from the global network of anti-human trafficking, or as long as Taiwan is invisible internationally, I would say more women and children will be victimized and will suffer. This ends my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sandy. Now Jacques will talk about questions of sovereignty and membership. Jacques?
Thank you for bringing the lights back up since first day of daylight savings time in the dark. I was about to pass out. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I've been asked to address questions of sovereignty and membership or participation in international organizations for Taiwan, describing the arguments about sovereignty or status and its implications for international organizations' membership. Obviously, the question of Taiwan's sovereignty or status has produced more arguments, claims, controversies, even crises than one could list in the 10 or 12 minutes that I have, let alone go into detail. Some of those are narrowly legal. Many of them are, at least superficially and in many ways seriously, political, but often the legal issues lurk just behind the surface and sometimes erupt into full view. So I've got a couple of tasks. The first part is to talk about the sovereignty and status issue, and the second part is to talk about international organizations. In terms of Taiwan's sovereignty and status, I think there are really three strands to this discussion. The first is, does Taiwan meet the criteria for statehood or something very close to statehood in the international system and specifically in international law? Here, the locus classicus is a dusty old document called the Montevideo Convention, but it basically states what most people take to be the customary international law standard. What do you have to have to be a state? Well, you have to have a distinct and substantial territory. Nothing like a good-sized island for meeting that. You have to have a distinct and substantial population. 20-some million without a whole lot of immigration, or emigration does pretty well. The mainlander-Bantu divide has faded enough, and the temporary residence of many Taiwanese on the mainland doesn't really undermine that. Third criterion, do you have a government? One that provides order at home and that doesn't answer to anybody else abroad. Again, pretty good metrics on that for Taiwan. Then it gets tricky. The fourth criterion is the capacity to engage in relations with other states. Here, Taiwan has some troubles on the formal side. No recognition by anyone of Taiwan as a separate state. A relatively small number, a couple dozen, of countries that either recognize the ROC government or more commonly maintain formal diplomatic relations with it. That number, of course, is stabilized with the de facto diplomatic truce. But, of course, as we're talking about today, Taiwan has been excluded from many international organizations, including the so-called state member-only ones. On the informal side, Taiwan does pretty well. Quite robust international relations, a massive network of quasi-diplomatic relations, informal diplomatic relations, or not quite diplomatic relations, membership in many, many international organizations, some IGOs and many INGOs, and participation without membership in a good many others. Then, you know, there was the old joke in China about the Gang of Four and Mao was the thumb. Well, there's the fifth of the four criteria for statehood, which is some assertion that the entity is, in fact, a state. And here it gets very, very complicated and complex. Of course, in the Jiang era, there was a resounding no. There was one China, included Taiwan. The only question was which government was the proper government of that China. And then it got complicated. Li Denghui's reference, of course, to cross-strait relations as being nation-to-nation or special state-to-state, not fully international but not fully domestic, came pretty close to a separate statehood claim, and his claim that the Republic of China was an independent sovereign state since what is now nearly 100 years ago, went a step farther. Chen Shui-bian, of course, farther out on that limb with Yibian Yiguo, one country each side, repeated references to the sovereignty of Taiwan, and scuttling part of the four no's, one not, particularly the National Unification Council and the guidelines for national unification. All of these sound a bit like they're edging toward a declaration. Ma Ying-jeou, of course, has spoken of the sovereignty of the ROC, sovereignty of the nation, and has insisted on significant equality in cross-strait negotiations, which, you know, gets you at least into ambiguous territory, and has articulated mutual non-denial between the mainland and Taiwan as policy goals. On the other hand, Ma has also said recently Taiwan and mainland that the contrast should be Taiwan mainland rather than Taiwan China, which backs away from things that look like a declaration. And, of course, the 92 consensus, which has an element of one China-ness to it, although with two separate interpretations. So a lot of things that come fairly close in many ways to the requisite declaration, and by some analyses would go up to and perhaps even over that line, but stopping short of something like saying there is a Republic of Taiwan or a totally separate state of Taiwan. That last bit shades into the second strand in the issue of Taiwan's sovereign status. And this is a factually overlapping but conceptually distinct question. Has Taiwan separated from China? Has it separated from mainland China? Essentially a question of secession. A change of state question rather than a measurement against some objective criteria of statehood. And here one needs to look at this long inventory of events, and this is why the PRC makes these lengthy white papers going back to the Qing dynasty and before. The question is, what is it that could have changed status with Taiwan? So you can go through the litany. You all know it. I'll do it very quickly. There's the strong assertion among Taiwan independence supporters that maybe China never had sovereignty over Taiwan. The exercise of rule was too thin in the Qing dynasty, and at the very least, Taiwan left with the treaty with Japan in the late 19th century, the Shimonoseki Treaty. And basically, you had very thin exercise prior to the 1890s, and then only briefly a central Chinese government ruling from 1945 to 1949. If you believe that, there's no need to separate. And of course, the PRC pushes back very hard, saying that treaty never meant anything, Taiwan never left. Then you fast forward through history, right? What happens after World War II? Taiwan was under Japanese sovereignty as a colony. After the war, on the PRC view, everybody agreed that Taiwan would go back to China. That's the Cairo and Potsdam declarations analysis. You know, another take on this is the surrender of Japanese forces to ROC forces on Taiwan, which meant Taiwan, on that theory, went back to the ROC. And one could argue from the PRC side, as the PRC does, that whatever the ROC had in 1945, the PRC got in 49 when it became the government of China, or one could take the other view that the ROC got the territory of Taiwan in 1945 and never gave it up. The logic of that is maybe that the mainland seceded from the ROC, but that's a complicated international legal argument that I wouldn't want to have to make. My rates are not high enough to get that kind of laughter. And then there's the argument that Chen Shui-bian trotted out in his litigation here in Washington when he was trying to avoid criminal prosecution, saying Taiwan has been under U.S. occupation. The U.S. is the leader of post-war occupation, and it never ended. And that throws Taiwan into limbo, and then you can cite the State Department never retracted statement about the to-be-determined status of sovereignty. We can look at the San Francisco Peace Treaty and the Treaty of Taipei, right? Japan renounces sovereignty. Where does it go? It goes up in the air in San Francisco. It lands a little more in Taiwan with the Treaty of Taipei. But on the PRC view, that ROC government after 1949 had no right to exercise any authority at all. So it becomes this incredibly complex litany, and that's why you get these long discourses in the white papers. The final piece of this old story is the notion that Taiwan may be a case of incomplete decolonization. Japan gave it up, and where did it go? And there were lots of post-war decolonizations. So all of those seemingly kind of dusty historical arguments are freighted with this question of, was Taiwan ever part of China, and there's some event that led to its departure. And here the events of more recent years start to weigh a bit more heavily as well. 60 years, more than 60 years, of de facto separate rule on many accounts matters. Whatever the legal niceties, that's a fact about the world that maybe law needs to take account of. Some of the statements I referred to above by Taiwanese leaders get awfully close to an event that would matter, that is a declaration of independence. I used to fantasize that Chen Shui-bian would stand up probably at the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial and say, Taiwan Mingguo Xian Zai Chuang Li Le, you know, but that wasn't going to happen. So what goes almost to that edge and doesn't go there, things like the referendum on joining the UN under the name of Taiwan is an assertion or very close to an assertion of statehood. That's why it caused such a dusting up or assertion of independence. That's why it caused such a dust-up in Washington, Taipei, and Beijing. So there are things like that that one can point to. The other issue during the Chen years, of course, was the new constitution, which might have suggested a new state because of a new constitution. Neither of those were unambiguous, but they got closer, and they stopped short of my fantasy. The third piece of this story about Taiwan's status is a squishier one. Because it doesn't speak to statehood. It doesn't speak to whether Taiwan meets the criteria of statehood, and it doesn't speak to whether there is an event that separated Taiwan or a claim that no event was necessary because Taiwan was never part of China. Instead, it invokes the softer things that matter for status, if not statehood, in the international system. Self-determination. You know, is there a people of Taiwan, a distinct people of Taiwan? If you make that argument, then they have a right to something which may or may not be full statehood. International law says you get autonomy, you get accommodation, and then it becomes a very dense factual inquiry. How much autonomy do you get? How much recognition of your separateness do you get? There's an underlying debate about how separate the Taiwanese people are. That's what led to Li Denghui's discussion of the new Taiwanese, a Taiwan Gemeinschaft, and that sort of thing. Ma, of course, has gone back more to talk about the common Chineseness on both sides of the strait, and this all speaks to that issue. Secondly, within this category, democracy and human rights matter. It doesn't get you over the threshold into statehood if you have a good record. It doesn't bump you below it if you have a bad record. But if you're in the gray zone, it's a good thing to be in step with international norms like human rights and democracy, especially Cold War. All right, let me turn, since I'm almost out of time here, to the second task, which is the implications for international organization membership and participation. And here there are a couple of issues that need to be untangled. The first is the question of organizational structure. What kinds of international organizations are we talking about? Many organizations are not states member-only organizations, and Taiwan, of course, has had relatively high success in participating in those and often joining them. The WTO is the biggest example, the large, robust international organization that Taiwan has gotten into. APEC is another, the ADB, the International Olympic Committee, lots of NGOs, and so on. And here, you know, Taiwan, again, has been successful despite lots of indignities with the nomenclature that we've heard about. But there are other types of organizations that are states member only, or at least are arguably states members only. The UN is the classic category here. Clinton's three no's more or less accept that categorization that Beijing has long pushed. And that's what made the UN referendum that Chen Shui-bian pushed particularly toxic. So what are Taiwan's options and tactics for dealing with organizations that are or might be states member only? One is to say, look, Taiwan is a state, it meets the criteria. Now, there may be some intellectual force to that argument, but politically it's something of a non-starter. Another is to point out the hypocrisy of the organization. Lots of entities that aren't full-fledged, indisputable, separate states have participated and indeed been members in the UN, the two Germanies being perhaps one example of at least temporary separation. And nobody really thought the Belarusian and Ukrainian SSRs were separate states when the Soviet Union had three seats in the UN. But most of the game that goes on here is something less than that. As you all know, it has been an attempt to engage with these kinds of organizations without full membership. And there are two routes here. One is a less than full membership status, something like observer status, or perhaps less, which has been accorded to non-state actors in the UN system. The alternative is not to talk about status, but to talk about some right or opportunity for participation without broaching the status question. And Taiwan has combined both these tactics in dealing with the UN, particularly the UN specialized agencies. The WHA is one example where there was much discussion about whether to go for observer status or, as the US had pushed, meaningful participation. And what came out of it was kind of a hybrid, a sort of ad hoc year by year, but likely to be renewed annually, observer status. Some of this discussion is now going on with the ICAO and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was talked about on the run-up to the Hu-Obama Summit, and now there's talk about meaningful participation in the technical side of the ICAO. And so there are lots of attempts to move incrementally here, but I want to stress the incrementalism. One is not the core UN, just the specialized agency. The other is not full membership, but these kind of other forms of participation. The problem with this approach is, of course, it's hard to build momentum. Beijing puts down lots of markers saying you can't use this as a precedent. It's done case by case. And some of this is actually a technical legal point. Each of the UN specialized agencies has its own funky structure. It's got its own constitutional arrangement for how you get membership or participation. It's got its own practices and norms. So it is kind of hard to build a lot of momentum. And once you get outside the UN specialized agency framework and talk about other international organizations, these questions proliferate. I know I'm out of time here, so I won't go into more detail except to say that the second question here that matters when we say what type of international organization is subject matter focus. Subject matter matters. And here I think there are a few strands. First, is Taiwan an important player in the regulated field such that you can say it is in the global interest to allow Taiwan to participate? WTO clearly does that. WHA does it, especially after SARS. Financial institutions, economic institutions, all that. Shipping, fishing, civil aviation, these are all arguments, nuclear energy, potential dual-use technology, all those kinds of things. Second, is the regulated field particularly important to Taiwan? This is a fairness argument. Taiwan is being hurt by being excluded. The world may be hurt too, but it's hurting Taiwan in an area that really matters. And here you can see SARS and trade being obvious issues, criminal laws, another talk about how Taiwan will be affected by global warming, these kinds of issues. Thirdly, has China wrong-footed it? Has China just really misplayed it in a way that's created sympathy for Taiwan? That's very much the SARS-WHA story. It may be another story with human rights, and especially if you juxtapose the Liu Xiaobo Nobel Prize and Beijing's reaction on the one side with Taiwan's rather late ratification of the long-ago signed human rights conventions, even though it can't deposit them. Last thing I'll say is that one final strategy available to Taiwan is not membership, not participation, but what I call as-if participation. Taiwan behaves in a way that says Taiwan will act as if it's a member of an international organization and will live up to all those standards. And that's a way of sort of making the point. And although much of this is about functional performance, as Richard said in his introduction, much of this is also about status. And the more Taiwan can walk and talk and act like a member of the regime, the more it gets those kinds of status benefits.
Thank you very much. Now we turn to Bonnie, who will talk about the diplomatic truce and Taiwan's international participation. Bonnie?
Good morning. Thank you, Richard. So I will focus on the diplomatic truce issue and its relationship to Taiwan's quest for international space. One week prior to his inauguration in a speech to the ROC Association of International Relations, Ma Ying-jeou proposed a diplomatic truce with Beijing, under which Beijing and Taipei would no longer compete for diplomatic ties with other states. And he repeated the diplomatic truce idea in his inaugural address and subsequently discussed it in many media interviews. It seems to me that President Ma had several objectives in putting forward this diplomatic truce proposal, and I won't go into all of them at length, but I do want to at least mention what I think they are. The first is what Jacques has just talked about, and that's essentially that retaining Taiwan's diplomatic allies are important to Taiwan's claim to be an independent sovereign state. Nobody in Taiwan talks about what numbers you have to have. Sometimes people say if you go down to the single digits, you're in trouble. But I think that President Ma really wanted to arrest the trend of declining numbers of Taiwan's allies. And secondly, I think part of President Ma's effort to improve cross-strait relations was also related to the diplomatic truce. Clearly, this eliminated a source of friction with Beijing, and President Ma did have the ambition to have a better relationship with China. Thirdly, President Ma wanted to improve Taiwan's own foreign aid program and its international image. He recognized that foreign assistance that was aimed at wooing allies from Beijing was promoting corruption in the countries that were receiving assistance, and it was harming Taiwan's international image. And President Ma, before he was elected, had received an earful when he had traveled to other countries and heard particularly, for example, from Australia, negative things about the competition between Taipei and Beijing in the South Pacific. And finally, President Ma had in mind the objective of expanding international space. He believed that a diplomatic truce would help to open the door to greater participation by Taiwan in various international organizations. So I would say in the first three of these objectives, I think President Ma has scored a good deal of success. He has had limited success in the fourth, increasing Taiwan's international space. Now, after President Ma unilaterally declared this diplomatic truce, Beijing didn't make any official response. But in essence, it abided by it. And in the months after President Ma came to power, China turned down requests by several Latin American countries, including Paraguay, Nicaragua, Panama, and Guatemala, to switch diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing. In a few of these cases, China apparently reneged on prior commitments to do so, but it felt that it was necessary to not use the competition for allies with Taiwan to improve its position vis-a-vis Taipei. It felt it had to respect President Ma's diplomatic truce, even though it didn't explicitly accept it. So to date, almost 3 years after President Ma's inauguration, Taiwan, of course, has not lost a single one of its 23 diplomatic allies. Now, let me turn to the issue of international space. I want to quote two sentences from President Ma's inaugural address. And he said, "I would like to call upon the two sides to pursue reconciliation and truce in both cross-strait and international arenas. We should help and respect each other in international organizations and activities." So it seems to me that in President Ma's mind, the diplomatic truce was, from the beginning, linked, at least loosely, to a hope that Taiwan would be able to expand its participation in the international arena. So, of course, in President Ma's first year in office, Beijing did show some diplomatic flexibility. This began first with accepting former Vice President Leon John's participation at APEC in the summit in 2008. And then, of course, a bigger success was achieved the following year when Taiwan, again under the name of Chinese Taipei, sought and received observer status in the World Health Assembly. Since then, there has been small progress, not major progress. And the major progress that Taiwan has sought, it identified in 2009 two organizations that Taipei wanted to have meaningful participation in, and that was the International Civil Aviation Organization and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Beijing, of course, has yet to respond positively on both of these organizations. Instead, China has called for cross-strait discussions to work out the terms of Taiwan's participation in international organizations overall, insisting that a solution cannot give rise to two Chinas or one China, one Taiwan. Now, notably, Beijing seeks to include in such discussions not only official international organizations, but also unofficial NGOs. Now, China has not only withheld support for further expansion of Taiwan's international space, it has also continued long-standing efforts to squeeze Taiwan's international space. In some instances, Beijing has tried to compel Taiwan to change the name that it uses in specific international organizations and, of course, in NGOs. In one well-known case that occurred last October, Chinese representatives at the 23rd Tokyo International Film Festival demanded that the Taiwan delegation be renamed the China-Taiwan delegation shortly before the opening ceremony. And when the festival sponsors decided to introduce the delegation separately as Taiwan and China, the mainland representatives then withdrew, and neither delegation was permitted to participate. In February this year, as part of an attempt by China to upgrade its membership status in the Asian Medical Students Association International, upgrade from observer to full membership, and Taiwan did not oppose this effort by the mainland, but as part of it, Beijing tried to compel Taiwan to change its name in the organization from Taiwan to Taiwan, China. And there are, of course, many other such examples. Still, Taiwan did make limited progress in the past year. I think Dr. Liu has already told us that last August, Taiwan did become a full member of the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission. And in January this year, even though it was not able to join ICAO, Taiwan did join the Civil Air Navigation Services Organization, known as CANSO, which in itself is an observer at ICAO. And so joining CANSO can help Taiwan to better synchronize its aviation regulations with those of the international community. Now, another measure of Taiwan's international space, although not directly related to international organizations, is its ability to negotiate trade agreements with other nations. And since others have not spoken on that, I just want to make a few points. As a WTO member, Taiwan does have the right to sign free trade or economic cooperation agreements with other members. Beijing, of course, has not encouraged this practice. The mainland apparently has given the nod to Singapore to begin talks with Taipei on economic cooperation agreement, and this took place last year. But it is said that it has to evaluate how that goes before it takes a position on other possible countries entering into negotiations with Taiwan on these economic agreements. So in other words, Beijing has to be certain that the One China framework remains intact. However, a few weeks ago, India announced that it had begun work on a feasibility study with Taiwan to pave the way for the opening of formal talks on a free trade agreement. And assuming that Beijing does not oppose this, I would say that that is a step forward. There's some evidence that the mainland is increasing pressure on other countries to treat Taiwan as part of the PRC. The most recent case took place this past month when the Philippines arrested a bunch of suspected Taiwanese criminals and extradited them to mainland China. Manila's representative office in Taipei issued a statement saying, quote, "The actions were taken considering that all the victims are Chinese, all the accomplices are Chinese, and the results can be best settled in China." It is not known whether the Philippines took this action under pressure from Beijing or whether it did it independently to curry favor with China. But either way, it suggests that despite the improvement in cross-strait relations and the success of the diplomatic truce in preserving Taiwan's allies, there may be a worrisome trend toward treating Taiwan as an entity that is part of the PRC. There are also cases of countries seeking permission from China prior to taking steps to strengthen ties with Taiwan to prevent punitive actions against themselves. This was certainly the case with Singapore. Singapore consulted with Beijing prior to the announcing its intentions to explore an economic agreement with Taiwan. And another example is the case of Malaysia, which recently announced that it is considering giving landing visas to Taiwanese citizens, but it would inform Beijing of its plan to avoid any unnecessary negative diplomatic impact, in the words of its representatives. So in conclusion, the diplomatic truce has been certainly successful in preserving Taiwan's diplomatic allies and in easing tensions with mainland China. It is difficult to assess, however, whether this diplomatic truce has in any way helped to pave the way for the limited progress that has been achieved in expanding international space in President Ma's 3 years in office. It's impossible to draw any judgment about whether the diplomatic truce enabled Taiwan to achieve such gains as observer status in the WHA or whether it really played no role whatsoever. But I would say that there is one conclusion that is irrefutable, and that is that Taipei continues to face very difficult challenges in its efforts to enhance its role and participation in international organizations, and Beijing continues to prevent Taiwan from gaining much ground. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you'll agree that we've had four outstanding presentations, and now we have some time for Q&A. Jacques Delisle will have to leave in the middle of the Q&A because he has to teach a class. Excuse me? Oh, okay. But since your students have already paid for your services, I wanted you to honor your contract with them. if you have a question, wait for the mic, and then identify yourself, if I haven't already identified you. And if you want to direct your question to a specific member of the panel, please so indicate. Who has the first question? Back in the back.
Claude Barfield, the American Enterprise Institute. I guess this is to Bonnie and or Mr. Dwyer, in addition to both of them touched on this. I'd like to go beyond the points you made about the free trade agreements and where the mainland stands and where Taiwan stands. Assuming for the moment that we're still going to get over the next few years opposition for expanding Taiwan's participation, and assuming also that the United States is going to continue to try to put together an regional economic architecture through APEC and through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what should the United States' position be down the road? Should we push to allow Taiwan to be in the Trans-Pacific Agreement at some point? How do we, assuming, I'm assuming also that other nations won't act out there without the United States acting one way or the other. What should our policy be?
Bonnie?
Well, the first question, of course, is Taiwan's interest in joining TPP. So far, I think the government has not made an official statement one way or the other. This is obviously a very robust agreement that would place demands on Taiwan that it is, I think, uncertain at the moment whether they would be willing to accept. But if Taiwan is interested in joining the TPP, my personal view is that we should welcome that, just as Taiwan has been a member of APEC. Now, there are many questions then again about the status and the nomenclature, but I think that excluding Taiwan from this regional economic integration process is harmful not just to the interest of Taiwanese citizens, but to the rest of the region, and certainly other countries in the world. So I would be in support of, if Taiwan is willing to meet the very high threshold of trade liberalization that would be required in the TPP, that the United States support that.
Ms. Priestley, I'd agree with that for very much the same reasons. I'd only underscore that it fits the basic model of it's in global interests, it's in Taiwan's interests, and in the U.S.'s interest if all, you know, if the U.S. and Taiwan both agree that it makes sense if Taiwan wants to push it. But beyond that, I'd say that the relationship to the broader issue we've been talking about here is preventing a backsliding. And one of the things, the WTO is under siege in a variety of ways. The Doha Round has famously run into trouble. But in the narrow cross-strait context, there's been a lot that China has done to essentially claw back some of the gains that Taiwan achieved and that the universality of the system achieved by including both China and Taiwan. So if you see ECFA, if you see China's ASEAN-China free trade area, these are all things that carve part of the trading relationship out of the WTO framework. That's not necessarily bad. There are all sorts of good reasons for regional trade agreements, but it does interact with the status question, and if China starts essentially bumping Taiwan down more outside the WTO context than in others, then we do have that dynamic going on. I think it's something rightfully to worry about from Taiwan's perspective and from the universality of a liberalizing trade regime perspective.
If I can follow up from a political perspective, if Beijing successfully excludes Taiwan from various regional and trade liberalization schemes, the implication of that, I think, would be to put even greater pressure on Taiwan as it seeks to maintain its economic competitiveness overall and for the long-term future. I can see that going in two directions in terms of how Taiwan responds. Either it gets really annoyed that it has been put in this position and so is less and less willing to talk long-term about resolving the fundamental dispute with the mainland, or it loses its confidence and runs up the white flag. I take that as agreement, or do you want to?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Gerard van der Wies, editor of Taiwan Communique. And a question on WHA, WHO. Much is being made by the Ma administration of the fact that every May the Minister of Health travels to Geneva and attends the meeting there sitting on the back row. But people in the health community, in the health field, tell me that there's hardly any participation by Taiwan health officials in the technical meetings, so everything still has to be channeled through Beijing. So this whole scheme that we do have now, isn't it more meaningless instead of meaningful participation?
I think that's probably a correct observation in a sense that in terms of WHA, for example, if you serve as observers, certainly you participate to some degree, but then since you're observers, so certainly you don't have a lot of extensive participation, just like a regular members in a sense. For example, there are some studies showing that in terms of the circulation of all the health rules or the bulletins, all kinds of information, Taiwan really received not a lot. That becomes a serious problem for Taiwan. In other words, on the one hand, you do receive the observer status in the WHA, but on the other hand, you really don't get any kind of things substantial at least, hopefully, in the future, maybe it will continue. After all, that's the first step. And then again, just go back to the discussion. We are dealing with China. China, certainly, again, every country, you've got a bureaucratic mentality, fragmentation inside the country in terms of decision-making process. Maybe the top, they are willing to be more compromising, but then you're dealing with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Sometimes it's very tough to really change their mindset. It's pretty much domestically, they got a one country, two system, in a sense.
Any other comments? Jacques?
Yeah, just briefly, I mean, you know, compared to what, right? I mean, it's better than the status quo ante of being completely excluded from any dealings with any UN organization, which had been China's position. On the other hand, a lot less good than a durable, not subject to being taken away each year, form of meaningful participation or full observer status, much less full membership. The one thing I'd layer onto that is the WHA was first because it was the easiest case, and the fact that it hasn't gone farther is somewhat disconcerting for those who hope to see it as a step forward, right? The issue started right after SARS when the PRC was in about as bad a position as one could be on that issue. Taiwan was especially vulnerable to the health consequences of SARS and was a pathway to the wider world. I mean, it really was the one that should have fallen fairly easily. It was still fairly hard, and Beijing has tried to contain the precedential value. So in that sense, if you want support for pessimism, I guess that's the support for pessimism. On the other hand, China said no for a long, long time, and this is something.
Mike Fonte.
Thanks. Thanks for a good panel. I'm Mike Fonte. I'm the Washington liaison for the DPP here in Washington. I want to get to a point that you raised, Dr. Lee, that one of the benefits of Taiwan joining international organizations, or Beijing allowing it to, would confirm the 92 consensus. And I guess by my logic, Beijing not allowing Taiwan to enter international organizations gives a lie to the fact that there is a 92 consensus. That the mutual non-denial that President Ma has tried to encourage has in fact not worked. That it's a one-way street. And I think Dr. Ye's position when she talks about being allowed into meetings or Taiwan's interaction with Interpol, Dr. Glaser's point about what's happened with the diplomatic truce underlies that point. I think this is a kind of a key point here that underlies the whole panel, that for Beijing, there's one China for sure, and that's the PRC. President Ma has tried to use his analogies, his confirmation of the constitutional framework as allowing for this fudginess. But I think that's an important point. Clearly, the DPP is very forceful on this, that there was no consensus around different interpretations, and I'd like to hear what folks would, how that plays out for them.
Dr. Lee, do you want to?
First of all, in terms of 1992 consensus, it's a one country, one China, different interpretations, and again, that's also in Taiwan. You have a different interpretation. Suddenly, KMT or DPP probably got a different view of it, and then also. And that's why I go back to what's in the name, what's the concept, what's the phrase implies for it, in the sense that there are all kinds of, someone even claimed that there's no consensus. It's understanding, it's spirits and all kind of things. That's the first point. But at least for the current administration, their point of view is, since Chen Shui-bian certainly tried to expand the international space, he got 8 years, and it sort of didn't come out very well. Becomes a troublemaker to some extent. And certainly I can also understand his point of view. You got a domestic identity politics playing into the politics extremely. So certainly you want to express it internationally. And then again, I show you the figures in terms of the Taiwan's identity politics, and then you can realize that 2008, you can see a lot of people, they identify themselves as a Taiwanese. It's going up. And then certainly not to mention that in 1990s, you got the Li Denghui, the big boss, certainly he's quite creative. And he pushed for that kind of a Taiwanese identity, indigenous identity, that kind of creation. So you got the domestic politics, Chen Shui-bian decided to push for external expression, international identity reconstruction. It did not go very well. So again, if that route doesn't work, plan B. Ma certainly come back, and certainly that also maybe his personal conviction or maybe the party programs, and you got all kinds of variables kick in. And so in that case, the plan A didn't work very well, plan B certainly kicks in. And that's the one thing I want to mention. Another thing also we want to mention is maybe in terms of getting to the academic jargons, in a sense, a security dilemma, in a sense that, well, it's you decide to push forward, and then even though you claim that, well, Taiwan self-determination, Jack just mentioned about all those sovereignty issues and the statehood, all these kind of issues. And then if it becomes tough, the other side also counter with the tougher measures. And so you drive out like an armed spiral, in a sense. And in this case, it's simply just competition spiral, keep on going up. So what Ma tried to do is, I don't know whether you recall it, during the electoral campaign at that time in 2008, he talked about smart strategy. One of the smart strategies, he said, well, I want to make sure that status quo is maintained. I want to make sure that we can expand the international space. And so the plan B is, well, I just try to calm down everything, reduce the tension, and so he pop up the 1992 consensus. I understand your view. 1992 consensus. What's the interpretation? Well, it depends on everyone's interpretation. But the key part, his view is he's more pragmatic. I can also assure you that in the past, Taiwanese government also, under whoever is in charge, also tried to be very pragmatic. Remember Li Dengwei talk about flexibility, all kinds of things, create all kinds of a term. So the point is, let's really try to bring down the tension, try to expand Taiwan's expansion. But unless you have a much better solution, and then I think that Mao probably is willing to listen to it. And just go back to the Tokyo Film Festival, that one. Again, you can consider that's an instant, just happened once, or maybe the top level, they want to do something, but the bottom level, again, they have that kind of cultural reconstruction process so long. Well, Taiwan's supposed to be China, and Taiwanese is supposed to be Chinese. And then they express it, and they thought they're probably fine. But then, probably it was not fun. Everything changed. And so in that case, you want to treat that instant as a one single instant, or you want to see, well, that's eventually showing that, well, there's some kind of a pattern over there. From Taiwan's point of view, at least from the current administration point of view, they will say, well, we try to calm down because we try to reverse that kind of a security dilemma issues. But whether that's successful or not, we're going to see.
The woman in the purple and aqua jacket, right up here.
Thank you. My name is Bing Wu with Story Times. My question is, I want to take the panelist's comments, also Dr. Bush's comments on Professor Charles Glaser's recent argument of abandonment of Taiwan for North Korea. And my second question is, the chairman of AIT recently announced that the arms sales to Taiwan won't, the U.S. won't sell arms to Taiwan until next March or April. And do you think this is a step backward of the U.S. on this issue? Thank you.
On your second question, I don't think we've heard that promise by Chairman Burkhardt, and I wouldn't give much credence
to it. I'm sorry, let me rephrase. He said the U.S. won't upgrade F-16AB until next March, let alone selling of X-16CD.
Perhaps you're confusing that with something that Rupert Hammond Chambers recently wrote. He's not the he's the chairman of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council. Is that what you meant?
No, AIT.
Okay.
Yeah.
Neither Richard nor I have read anything by the chairman of AIT statements referring to the F-16 upgrade, so I don't think we can comment on that. I don't think any U.S. official has said publicly when we are, as a government, are going to consider that. I don't think anybody has said that it's not possible this year.
Bonnie, do you want to talk about Charles Glaser, who is not related to you? Charles Glaser is a great scholar from a theoretical point of view. But applying that theory to specific situations requires a deep understanding, particularly in this issue area. And I don't think Professor Glaser has that necessary deep understanding in this case. Anybody else? Disagreements? Russell. Right over there.
Russell Schell with the Jamestown Foundation. I'd like to thank the panelists for a great presentation. I think it covered a lot of grounds. I initially had two questions, but one was taken by Mike over there, which is about the 92 consensus and the an assessment of the one country different interpretation policy and its sort of impact on Taiwan's ability to participate in international organization. And I just wanted to get comments from the other panelists as well about what they kind of sort of assess the policy to be and how effective it has been in contributing to Taiwan's participation in different international organizations. Secondly, I want to actually hone in on the case that was brought up by Bonnie, which is the case about the extradition of Taiwanese nationals to mainland China by the Philippines authority. And I wanted to kind of, I guess, also again ask the panelists to discuss the legal implications of this and what kind of precedents this sets, because in my understanding, this is sort of unprecedented in the sense of Philippines in sending Taiwanese nationals to mainland China and what it not. If there are any legal implications on Taiwan's status and so forth. And I guess there's also another area that I wanted to also bring up, which is to really hone in on the issue of the diplomatic truce on what Professor DeLisle mentioned about the fifth article of the Montego Convention, which is, you know, of course, the some assertion that it is of statehood. And it seems to me, at least, that the current administration, Ma Ying-jeou's administration, is downplaying that article. And whether or not you see that as being the case, and your sort of interpretation on this matter. Thank you.
I'll take a couple of those. Certainly in terms of things that count as the implied clear statement rule, that is saying, you know, this is a state, a sovereign state in international relations, international law, you know, clearly the Ma administration has taken a more ambiguous, less assertive line than Chen Shui-bian and then at least parts of Li Donghui. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Chen danced right up to the edge of the red line, somewhere in the pink fringes of it. Ma's language has been much less in that vein. The references to China, the references to the Republic of China, yes, there are references to Taiwan mixed in, but it's certainly short of where Chen was going, especially with things like one country each side and things like the discussion of a new constitution, which doesn't mean a new state, but could mean a new state, and UN membership under the name of Taiwan. Those were all things that got very close to a statement that Taiwan is a state distinct from the mainland, rather than assertions of sovereignty for the ROC, which rules Taiwan, or the sovereignty of the nation, and leaving ambiguous whether we're talking about Taiwan or China, and really any openness to a one-China notion, even with respective interpretations, as opposed to it being a possible distant future reunification thing. Those all make a difference on that stature. That said, though, you know, I don't think the diplomatic truce is a big part of that. I think, if anything, the diplomatic truce is a tactical accommodation that doesn't entail retreat, and there's a sense that it was a better way to do it. And this is implicit, I think, in what Bonnie was saying, that the fear was that the 23 was going to keep dropping and dropping and dropping. And when that happens, you've got a real problem to the extent that that fourth, unlike the fourth actually articulated criterion for statehood, is that you maintain relations with other states. Formal is better than informal. And so trying to stop the bleeding, I think, is actually a way of keeping an assertion of state status, or at least the government status, which implies a degree of statehood. As to the extradition issue, the issue there is one needs a clearer reading than I think we have. I haven't followed this in enough detail, so I may have missed something, but I think we need a clearer reading than we have so far of why the Philippines sent people back. There is nothing problematic, really, under international law, unless you have a treaty constraining you, which doesn't apply here. There's nothing problematic about sending state A's nationals to state B if they committed a crime in state B. You know, you're state C. You know, Philippines says these Taiwanese were doing something bad in China or doing something bad with an effect in China. You could still think Taiwan, Philippines, and China are all countries, and it's still okay to send them back to China. If they said, we're sending them back to their home country, we are extraditing your citizens back to you, and that were clearly the statement, then you've got obviously a problematic assertion, but you know, it doesn't. It's not the essential condition to having done the sending. And just finally on the. On the 92 consensus, just one other piece I wanted to add to the story, which I mentioned earlier, is that one of the other tactics that Taiwan has tried in this, and this is one that can float around despite the changes in different presidential assertions, is essentially a claim of universal representation, right? The people of Taiwan need to be covered by these supposedly universal systems, the human rights regime, the UN regime, and Beijing can't effectively do that. And so one way around all these problems of asserting Taiwan as a state that represents the people of Taiwan in the system is to say, whatever you think of it, the people in Taiwan need to be part of the health regime, need to be part of the human rights regime, and there's no other entity that can really represent them absent some level of participation from Taiwan, whatever it is.
Let me add a few things on the Philippine incident. First, I don't know if anybody else is clear. Richard and I are not clear whether the 14 criminals were actually deported or whether they were extradited. So I'm not too clear. But in any case, I think that in this instance, probably something positive has come out of a negative situation, where now the Philippines agreed to take some actions in order to, you know, help Taiwan save face on this issue, including firing their chief of, I think it was immigration. And in addition, there was another criminal that was recently arrested, and that person was sent back to Taiwan. So the Philippines is essentially saying, okay, we'll do it your way in the future. We won't send them to the mainland. In addition, there was an official that went from Taipei to Beijing to discuss the fate of the 14 who had been deported or extradited from the Philippines. And now the mainland is apparently willing to begin to send some of them. I think it's the first group will be seven of them back to Taiwan. So in this case, maybe something positive came out of that. On your question, just briefly relating to the 1992 consensus as a basis for improving relations and its implications for international space, I think it was very clear before President Mao was elected that Beijing had told the KMT that this was a minimum position in order to resume the CFE-RATS talks, in order to begin to improve the relationship. Of course, the KMT had a prior position that it recognized, the 1992 consensus, so it wasn't a concession, and so they have stuck with that position. Now, I think that in at certain junctures, the mainland is looking to see whether they have to give President Ma something in order to help him shore up his domestic political position. And I think in his first year in office, it was beginning in 2009, that they agreed to the WHA. And that was a big deal for President Ma, and I think it showed in the polls. In 2010, I think the big issue was ECFA. And, in fact, I think that the KMT government really didn't attach a lot of importance or priority, I should say, to the international space issue. ECFA was really the highest issue on the agenda. And now, going forward, I think if President Ma is low in the polls, if China is worried about whether or not he'll get reelected, yes, international space is another area where Beijing can do something for Taiwan going forward. And maybe giving the nod to Singapore and maybe India is part of that calculus.
Just one quick correction. You're right, it is deportation, not extradition. Okay. Deportation is typically back to your home country, but not necessarily.
And I would note that if there was a change in consciousness in Pakistan and they captured Osama bin Laden, we would want him here on the next available flight. We would not care that he's a citizen of Saudi Arabia, right? Walt Slocum.
Very good.
Thanks for coming. It's nice to see you.
Thanks for an excellent series of presentations, which I suspect I'm the only non-expert in the room, was very informative. I'd like to ask a question about the broader international aspect of this. I'm not sure who it was. One of you made the point that the WHA move was possible because of a sense, both that China had wrong-footed itself, and second, that there was a powerful international reason to, which is sort of related to the universal representation issue. Are there other areas in which international pressure or international wishes, so that this is not strictly a China-Taiwan or even U.S.-China-Taiwan issue. And the converse is Taiwan is not the only situation in which there's an ambiguous existence of a state, the most obvious being Israel and the occupied territories. Are there, and this is, I suppose, mostly to Professor Delisle, are there other countries that take an interest in this issue, not because of the Taiwan-China issue, but because of the implications for other sovereignty or status questions in which they have a direct interest? Thanks.
I mean, I think that Taiwan's leaders have been very much attuned to this issue. That is, you know, the what are the things that look most like the WHA? Now, you're unlikely to get the perfect storm of a seemingly non-political issue, a really scary pandemic, and China botching it as badly as they did. But if you look around the way Taiwan has pushed other areas, it has been to make primarily the claim, that's not fair. One of the important tactics has been to look at these where the exclusion of Taiwan has harmful effects to the global system. I think that's one of the reasons that we saw ultimately the push at the end for WTO membership. Taiwan was a major trading entity. It had come into conformity with the rules, and that was part of what was going on in pushing China to strike a deal before it got really ugly. I mean, would the WTO have admitted Taiwan without China? No. But it gave Taiwan, I think, more leverage. I think you see it with the ICAO. The argument that there's a lot of air traffic around the straits. Taiwan is a major air shipping entity. So if you have them out of the system, there are risks. You play the 9/11 card, right? If you can't have a unified international system for air traffic, for shipping with IMO, money laundering is another area of financial things. Basically, anywhere where if you leave Taiwan out of the system, there's a big hole because Taiwan is important, or leaving Taiwan out of the system creates a possible route around a universal system, which is true with a lot of the crime issues, particularly financial crime and money laundering, that becomes a powerful argument. I think that's why Taiwan has emphasized those sectors as the next best steps. They also have the virtue of not being overtly political. I mean, health, fish, you know, environment, crime, everybody can agree those are good or bad things, depending on where you are on the list. As to the other sort of ambiguous entities in international systems, this is going to get back to Richard's dig at the other glazer, which is that theoretically there's a nice symmetry. Politically, nobody wants to go there. Taiwan is the third rail of our lives here, but Israel and the Palestinian territories are a problematic analogy for all sorts of reasons. I mean, in some ways even more controversial, and certainly scrambling some of the international left-right alignments, shall we say, compared to Taiwan. What's your other big candidate? Well, North Korea, is the other sort of entity with the most questionable status, but that's not an analogy one really wants to push either. It's desperately clawing for status, and Taiwan gets some weird indirect benefit because China is so committed to North Korea's continuing status that international opprobrium and isolation doesn't really take them out of the mix of states on China's view, and that maybe helps a little bit. But the tactic from Taiwan has much more been to stress the entities that make it over the hump. So when you see the various fragments of the former Yugoslavia, including most recently Kosovo, that kind of discussion, I think is where that international system behavior tends to be a plus for Taiwan.
I mean, Walt, I would say that the other possible candidates have lacked two things that Taiwan has. One is the international footprint, and second, the state capacity to make a contribution. And so this is sui generis. Does anybody else?
Can I just add one thing? The other piece to your question, Walt, it's not just, of course, whether there's an issue in which other countries will sympathize and then put pressure on China. It's also the structure of the individual organizations. So if there is an observer status, like there was in the World Health Assembly, then it becomes easier for Taiwan potentially to join. If the charter of an organization doesn't allow for observer status, and Taiwan can only join as a member, and I think this is the case, but you probably know better than I do, of UNFCCC. Now, Taiwan NGOs...
The UN writ large does.
I'm not sure about that individual organization. I was told that Taiwan has NGOs that participate and that the next step would actually be joining and that Taiwan had applied for membership, but perhaps I'm wrong in that. But I think that's, again, that's just one of the challenges. If they want to join an organization, they have to have, there has to be some category in the charter that enables them to do so.
Or you can change the charter.
And that's very complicated.
I understand. I understand. Yeah. I understand. Any final questions? Right here.
Nancy Talbot, Department of State, East Asia Pacific Bureau. I just have a clarification and a question. My clarification is in regard to the question you asked about arms sales. I just wanted to echo what the panelists said, that arms sales are continually under review. There is not a timeline that we can say on that. My question has to do with FTA-like agreements. It's probably for Bonnie or maybe for one of the other panelists regarding India, since we've been hearing a lot about that in the press. Do you have any indication from your discussions with the PRC, whether scholars or government officials, on how receptive or not they might be to something like that with India specifically?
I can only speak in general terms, and perhaps others know more than I do, that from my conversations with very senior Chinese officials, I had the impression that Singapore was a test case, that the mainland wanted to see how that was managed, and of course, the negotiations have really not yet gotten underway, and could take a year or longer, and I had heard very clearly from officials that they did not want to see other cases going forward. So I was frankly surprised to even read about the India case, though I would be really shocked if India went forward with this without consulting with China. So my guess is that there was some kind of a conversation and that India and China came to some understanding. But that part of it is just, total speculation. But I was rather surprised. Perhaps this is related to the various tensions that have been taking place between China and India.
With that, I think we've come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank all of you for coming and for your great questions, and particularly thank the panelists for their outstanding presentations and their answers. Thank you very much. Thanks also to the staff, and the meeting's adjourned.